Well, welcome and good afternoon, and thank you all for joining us today for the Nebraska Emergency Treatment Orders webinar. My name is Tammy Bauman with Great Plains Quality Innovation Network, and I am one of the quality improvement advisors in Nebraska. Great Plains Quinn is the Quinn QIO for Kansas, North Dakota, Nebraska, and South Dakota. Our aim is to achieve better healthcare, improved health, safer, and lower healthcare costs. I would like to welcome and thank our audience for your participation today. Today's webinar will be recorded and posted to our website, www.greatplainsquinn.org. Please note it'll take about a week to access the recording, and because of some snow in Virginia, we will have audio for the recording only. There will be an opportunity for questions after today's presentation, or you can post any questions via the chat function on the bottom right of the screen. Paula Sitzman will be monitoring the chat feature throughout today's WebEx session. Our Great Plains Quinn QIO Care Coordination Team works on forming community coalitions throughout the region to unite providers, stakeholders, and consumers in reducing avoidable hospital readmissions, admissions, and medical harm. You can always keep up to date by joining our Learning and Action Network on the Great Plains website. Our website is full of tools and resources, and the LAN is a wonderful opportunity to stay up to date and connected. Great Plains Quinn QIO now has social media presence, so you may like and follow us also on Facebook at Great Plains Quality Innovation Network or Twitter, Great Plains Quinn at Great Plains Quinn. Now I would like to introduce our speaker, Dr. Lou Lucas. Dr. Lucas is an alumni of UNMC College of Medicine, board certified in family medicine and hospice and palliative medicine, and graduate of the Robert Wood Johnson Clinical Scholars Program at the University of Michigan. She's designed and launched programs for seriously ill people in Pennsylvania, Maryland, and Nebraska, including being the driving force behind the Nebraska Emergency Treatment Orders, or NEDO. She's currently the medical director for palliative care at Methodist Health System in Omaha. We thank Dr. Lucas for taking the time to present today and for sharing her knowledge and expertise with us. I'm now going to turn the presentation over to Dr. Lucas. Should be moving to you, Dr. Lucas. There you go.
I have the ball. Tammy, thank you very much for your invitation to work with this group, because I think it's a great opportunity to foster improved quality of care through improved continuity of care. So thank you very much for inviting me, and thanks everybody who's called in. I appreciate your attention, and I think it will be a great opportunity for us to work together to think about how we take better care of the people of the state. And I heard that there are people from the Veterans Home who might be on the line, and currently, as of this moment, I'm a Methodist in Nebraska, in Omaha, but I'm actually moving to the VA next month, so I look forward to working with you guys more closely, too. So I'm going to see if I've got the right button here to go. There I am. So the title of this is called Practical Strategies for Advanced Care Planning, Introducing NEDO. And what you see here also is a logo we developed called Speak for Yourself, which is a patient-facing campaign to really get across this idea that the best thing a person can do for themselves and their family is use their own voice and speak for themselves to think about what they want in case an emergency happens. And for those of us in Nebraska, we're really familiar with planning for emergencies like tornadoes and blizzards and things. And just as we know that we're supposed to put candles and spare food and water in our basements during tornado season, we should also be thinking about what would I want if something happened to me that made me unable to participate in my medical decisions. What would happen to me if I got hit by a bus, if I had a sudden stroke, if something happened? And this presentation will kind of take us through a new tool called NEDO, which stands for Nebraska Emergency Treatment Orders. And I seem to be a little bit delayed when I'm pushing my page down button. So let me just see if I can use this button instead. So in quality improvement, I think sometimes we think that our job is to prevent train wrecks. How many times do we sit at an event that's happened and we think, how did this train jump the tracks? How did we get so far from where we were trying to go? You can't even tell in this picture. You know, it looks like maybe there was a bridge here once that looks like there was a train that was trying to get lumber, and there are a whole bunch of people scratching their chins going, oh my, what happened here? And I think our goal is to avoid train wrecks as much as possible, because train wrecks in our business look a lot different than this. Train wrecks for us look a little bit more, and I am having some difficulty transitioning here. Train wrecks for us look a little bit more like this. And those of you who work in hospitals are altogether too familiar with this situation, where we've got a patient who's really sick. She's on a ventilator and dialysis and a whole bunch of other things hanging from that IV pole. And, you know, it's one of those mixed blessings, right? This is a fabulous place to be. If you're the person who got hit by the bus and you absolutely need everything that medicine has available to us, because we can do lots of things to save people's lives. But this is not such a good place if you were the very happy 92-year-old woman who was just waiting for God to take her to be with her husband, but she didn't write that down anyplace. And so when her grandchildren found her on the floor, they rushed her to the hospital, and now she's on a ventilator, and people are going, now what do we do? This doesn't look like a very good idea. It doesn't look like something she'd wanted. And so she's getting treatment that she didn't necessarily want. And in the meantime, if you're those of us who are involved in some more quality things, it triggers all the things we're not looking for. And the specific example I gave you is one that I had on my service, where we had a patient come in who did not have a palliative medicine consult on her previous hospitalizations, that she came in for what looked like a small intracranial hemorrhage, but she was fine when she left, and she made it very clear to everybody that if it had been worse, she didn't want anything fancy. She didn't want to be resuscitated. She didn't want to be on a ventilator. But that information just kind of got swallowed up in the chart, and she was transferred back to her home because things were going quite well for her. Lo and behold, 23 days later, she was in the emergency room, obtunded. She was immediately intubated and sent up to the ICU even before her family got there. And, of course, as soon as her family got there, they said, oh, Grandma never wanted this. She just told us she didn't want to be intubated. She didn't want to be in the ICU. If anything happened, she wanted just to be allowed to pass gently. And so then her family had to look at her and say, oh, now my job is to take this away. And it was such a burden for them, because they thought, well, you know, maybe if we gave her a few more days, maybe if this, maybe if that. And they really suffered through making that decision, even though they knew perfectly certain that that's what she wanted. So the reason that this idea came about, this Nebraska Emergency Treatment Orders, is to help us do a better job of addressing that situation. Again, if people who are familiar with quality really know that what's important is that we get to a root cause. You know, how did we get here? How did we get to this place where we had a woman who was really clear about what she wanted, and she was pretty, you know, at her age and with what she had, it was pretty predictable that something bad was going to happen in the not that distant future. Nobody knew that it would be that exact thing or that exact time. But how do we get into this place where we routinely do this with patients? And so it's important, I think, to step back and really look at what are the root causes and what are some of the historical precedents. So I'm sorry if the next couple of slides are a little on the dry and legalistic side, but I think it's important for us to go through and review some of the history that got us here. Because in my work as a palliative doctor, I am amazed at how, and also in my work in helping to develop this, amazed at how little we understand about the laws, regulations, and history that got us to where we are. Oh. Yeah. So yeah, I'm having a hard time driving. I'm pushing, but there we go. So the basis for what we now call advanced care planning stems from the notion of patient autonomy. And even I found that was misunderstood as we got through it. There's something in U.S. law called common law, and that's the law that is produced every single day when judges hear cases and make determinations. And those determinations are then used as the precedent for the next case that comes up. So when a case goes to court, the judge doesn't just sit there and say, you know, doesn't put his finger in the wind and say, my mood today is this. They go back and they look through the history of what's happened in the court. And this idea of the right to refuse treatment is firmly entrenched in U.S. law, not from the Patient Self-Determination Act that a lot of us are familiar with, but it dates back to the first case was heard in 1891, over 100 years ago. And in a further case that was really well spelled out in 1914, it says every human being of adult years and sound mind has the right to determine what shall be done with his own body. And a surgeon who performs an operation without his patient's consent commits an assault. And that idea right there, that we can't touch patients unless they give us permission, is the basis for everybody's right to refuse treatment from that period forward. So when people point to things like our living wills, yeah, that's kind of it. Those laws inform it, but the law is much deeper and much older and much more consistently upheld than this. So there are a couple of exceptions. All competent adults can refuse treatment even if it appears unwise or foolish. So we can say, oh, no, this would be easy to fix. And the patient can say, no, I don't want you to fix it. And we don't have any right to contest that unless the patient, A, is pregnant, or B, appears to clearly lack capacity. And usually that's a very high standard to meet. You have to go a long way to say that the person lacks capacity. There are emergency exceptions for obtaining consent. So if a person presents unconscious, we assume that they have given us consent. And the paradox between those two, that on one hand we assume the patient's won treatment, but on the other hand they have the right to refuse it, is some of what causes the problems that we experience. And just to let everybody know, there is no parallel right to demand treatment. And so we know this like most clearly because patients who can't pay often don't get treatment. A patient can't say, I want you to treat me. And we all know that there are patients who would like treatment but can't have it for one reason or another. Or the treatment might not be appropriate. So if I say, I want my appendix out, the doctor is going to say, you don't have appendicitis. I'm not taking your appendix out. And so a patient doesn't have a right to demand treatment. So now if we move not to the history of the law, but the history of how we got into the situation, that the laws were on the books, but they weren't needed very often because up until the early 60s, we didn't have anything that could actually keep people alive longer than they wanted. We were lucky enough to have treatment that did what we wanted to do, let alone keeping people alive in a situation where their body would not normally allow that. And so we get the history of really starting with CPR. In 1957, it was started with the intention of treating unexpected sudden cardiac arrest, such as drownings, electrocutions, and arrhythmias. And the goal was to maintain circulation while the underlying cause was reversed. It was popularized by the Red Cross in the 60s and spread all over the country in terms of basic life support in community settings. It was given as training to lifeguards and babysitters. And then in the late 60s, it became introduced into hospitals because emergency physicians and anesthesiologists thought it was a really interesting idea. So you can see this where it moves from a more lay setting where accidents are tending to happen and where really bad things are not common. And when somebody drops suddenly, it's more likely to be from a reversible event as opposed to when you move it into the hospital where we've clustered all of the sick people, right? So your pretest probability for having a condition that you can't recover from is much higher if you're in a hospital. So, but our lines get blurred when it starts coming into the hospital. And because the outcomes were so different at that point, if you're out at the pool and the 15-year-old falls into the pool, the odds of resuscitating them are actually pretty good. If you come into the hospital where the average person's in here for CHF or COPD or some kind of malignancy, the odds are not that good at all. And so in 1974, the American Heart Association makes a formal recommendation saying that physicians should recommend DNR status to patients who have a poor likelihood of success. And I don't think that edict got carried out very well because we're a little bit resistant sometimes to think about it. We think about, oh, the patient has the right to choose CPR, and that's a whole other history in and of itself. But actually, the role of the physician is actually to tell patients when they're a bad candidate for it. And that was affirmed by the American Heart Association a long, long time ago. So as the legal history continues, we continue to see problems with what happens when we try to give people more treatment that they wanted. And there are were specific laws that went into effect that started in the 70s and the 80s and then spread across the country. Nebraska was one of the last states to adopt the law, and they adopted theirs in 1991. So the first set of laws were about advanced directives. And these were supposed to take the form of a statement that a patient would make to withhold or withdraw treatment. And then as it became, we had a patchwork of laws across all the states. Another law was adopted in 1991, which was a federal law, which requires that all institutions ask patients upon admission if they have advanced directive and to provide information to them if they want it. And it made a lot of requirements for us in terms of making sure that every healthcare institution that receives any money from the government has to accept an advance directive. We're obligated to accept them, we're obligated to act upon them, and we're obligated to provide information about them. And we're not allowed to discriminate against people who have them. And then based on that law, the Joint Commission implemented lots of things in policy that says that all institutions are required to have a policy about resuscitation status and about handling advanced directives. So what we've learned is that these policies vary widely between institutions, and some institutions lean towards what we think of beneficence or doing what's best for patients, and they tend to have policies that say we recommend certain forms of advanced directives or we recommend for or against treatments that we think might be harmful. Others lean towards autonomy, and they sort of say, well, you know, the obligation is on the patient, and the obligation is the patient should be making these choices. But just be aware that just because you guys have a policy, your policy might not look very much like the policies at the institutions next to you. And then if we move forward, despite the fact that we went through years of this, and some folks who are old enough remember these cases of Karen Ann Quinlan, Nancy Cruzan, Terry Schiavo, all of those gave us these examples of these people who are sort of getting futile care that we believed that the patient didn't want. But all of the work that went into it basically doesn't work, right? I know you can't talk back to me at the moment, but just inside, how many of you have seen that, like, our living wills and power of attorneys are regularly doing exactly what they wanted? Not so often. More frequently, we get these pieces of paper that don't say very much, even though they're quite long. They don't give us the answers that we need in a time frame that's useful to us. And so we think, why are they not working so well? Why are, you know, digging deeper into what's the real root cause of our problem? The first part is that powers of attorney are rarely prepared to make the kinds of decisions they are. And even when they are well prepared, it's extraordinarily difficult for someone who has an emotional attachment to a patient to, quote, make a decision or carry out the patient's own decision if it means that patient's going to die. It puts a level of burden and responsibility on them that is just, as an emotional human being that we are, as our social being that we are, it's really hard for people to do that. So even the best prepared, best informed people have a hard time doing this. But lots of times we don't have well-prepared folks, so they don't know what the decision was. They're afraid of annoying other family members. They might have actually motivations that are against what the patient wanted. They might want the patient to be kept alive so that they can keep, you know, benefits that patient might be getting, or they might not have a place to live. And so we've got a whole host of reasons why turning to another person to make the decision doesn't work out so well for the patient in many cases. And so why are we asking somebody else to make the decision? Well, the reason is because the living will is either absent or it was poorly written, and in truth, there seems to be a problem in the very format of the living will document. Many of the reasons are, first, they're written by lawyers, not doctors, so they say lots of things that sound legally appropriate, but when it comes time to making a decision, it just doesn't provide the answers that you wanted to. The documents are non-standard in form and in content, so you don't know where to look to get the information that you want. And the directives are contingent upon a phrase that says, if I am in an incurable or irreversible condition, which means just by definition, by the fact that those words are in there, it means you can't effectively refuse the initiation of emergency treatment. So if you've got a document that includes that language, and most of them in the state of Nebraska do, because there was a sample document that was included in our legislation, if you say that, no emergency room doctor is going to say, I know for sure this is irreversible. They're not in the position. They don't know the person beforehand. They didn't know what happened. So they say, I can't make a determination that this person is irreversibly ill, so I'm going to treat them and let the person downstream handle them. And what we've learned is once that slingshot gets pulled back and the emergency room physician launches the patient onto a high level of care trajectory, it's really hard to change that trajectory once they've left the hospital or once they've left the emergency room. So in order to try to combat this situation that we have where the existing living wills and powers of attorney didn't work very well, many states turn to something called PULSE, Physician Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment. Started in Oregon about 1985 and spread through there. About 35 states either have them in law or functionally sustained by professional endeavors. And it stands for Physician's Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment. And there were several attempts in the Nebraska legislature to get that through. But for whatever reasons, the legislature didn't act upon it. The most recent effort happened 2 years ago, and we put together new legislation to try to change some of Nebraska's laws and to adopt the PULSE. We didn't get the reception that we were hoping for. The Bar Association basically said, we like the laws we have, and we don't really want them changed. And the guidance we got was, this is a professional issue, that the medical community should actually come up with a solution. You guys come up with a solution, show us that it works, and we will be happy to put it into law for you. So we did. A group of us, I just got something that said it's not a valid menu option, so I hope that you guys can still hear me. We did. A group of us who were involved in that initial task force sat down. We got a coalition of accountable care organizations to say that they supported it, and Nebraska Health Network took the leadership role, keeping lots of other people in the mix, but they're the ones who basically put the funding behind it to do the work it took to build something that would work within the existing confines of the laws of the state of Nebraska. So we made this thing called a Nebraska Emergency Treatment Form. In some ways, it's informed by the PULSE paradigm. In some ways, it varies substantially from it so that it fits the specific interests of Nebraska and the way our laws are written. And at this point, I realize that I don't actually have a picture of it here for you, but at the end, there's a link that you can go and see all these documents. So the NEDO is a hybrid form. It's a single-page, bright yellow form. On one page, it is a declaration, which is another word for a living will. It's the legal term to describe a living will. And the patient in that declaration says, I give my consent to accept, refuse, or limit treatment. And then there's a standardized set of things that they're actually speaking to. On the other side of the form, there are orders that a physician writes for EMS. So the intention is that this is a document that is written collaboratively between a medical professional and a patient and their family. It is standard in form and content, so every form looks exactly the same until the patient makes their selections on it. So that if you're an EMS person or if you are a physician or a care provider in a facility or in an emergency department, you know exactly where to look to get the information that you needed. It was not designed to be comprehensive, but it was designed to track the most important decisions in a manner that makes sense in the order in which medical emergencies tend to present. And the only contingency that operationalizes the form is that the patient has a life-threatening condition and they lack the ability to make a decision for themselves. And you guys can read the declaration for yourself later when the form itself is available. So the form itself is designed to be available through medical providers because we think that the best decisions are made in collaboration with someone who can explain the implications of those forms, and so that we could also make some statements about the state of the person who is making the declaration. We got some really good feedback from lawyers and judges. And one of the most important things that the judges told us is that if there were to be a case and someone presented a form like this to me, the thing that I would want to know is that the patient knew what they were talking about and that they were competent at the time it was signed. And of course, the only way you can know that they're competent is having decision-making capacity is to have a medical professional say that. And so this form actually addresses a little bit of that. So it's available through medical providers. It's highly visible, bright yellow paper, standardized. Orders for EMS signed by a physician on one side and a declaration signed and notarized or witnessed by the patient on the other side. So one side gives direction to physicians. The other side is physicians giving direction to people who have subordinate licenses like EMS providers, nurses, et cetera. Ideally, these are created in an outpatient setting, but quite frankly, we're finding it most advantageous to work on the inpatient setting for our high-utilizing patients and patients who have serious illnesses. It takes a lot more to ingratiate this into outpatient a clinical setting, but we're working on that as well. The form is designed so to be created in the outpatient setting. It's owned by the patient, and so it's a declaration, just like their living will. The document belongs to the patient, and it stays with them, or if the patient's in a facility, it stays on their chart, and it's transported by EMS. So it should go from place to place with patients, carried by the person who is transporting them. When you look specifically at the document, it's comprised of four sections on the declaration side. The first one is, how do we start treatment? What is the scope of treatment you want when an emergency initially happens before we know what maybe happened? Like, we know that we found you on the floor, but we might not know what actually caused you to fall on the floor. And there are three basic choices. Do you want everything? Do you want to go to the ICU with everything we can do? Do you want limited or conservative medical treatment? Or do you want comfort measures? And those are explained in more detail on the form and on the educational material that comes along with it. The next section is, what are the indications that you would want to consider stopping treatment? Because in practice, the most common thing that people will say when they make an advanced care plan is, I want to try, but not too hard. So there are patients, if you simply are dealing with, do you want treatment or not want treatment, most people will say, well, I think we should try. But if you keep asking, they'll say, I want to try, but I don't want to go crazy about it. I want to try a little bit. And then there are reasons that people want to stop treatment. And so we found the reasons that were most common for people. So there's a notification that says, no, I don't actually want you to stop treatment. I want you to continue as long as there's a medical indication to continue treatment. And the next section says, why would you want to stop? And those reasons include, the first one is because treatment's not working. The second is because I have sustained significant brain damage. The third is I might not be able to live independently. And the fourth is, if my friends and family look at me and say the benefits of this treatment do not meet the burdens that are being caused by this treatment. So basically what you're saying is that the person saying, I understand that I want to stop treatment, and here's some basic guidelines that you can follow once treatment has started. The third section is C, which is CPR status, a simple yes or no. And the fourth is long-term artificial feeding. In studying this, we found that in the acute setting, everyone who's eligible for medically administered nutrition and hydration gets it. But when the acute phase of treatment is over, if the patient is still unable to speak for themselves, would they want to be sustained with long-term artificial nutrition and hydration? So that's the declaration side. It does not answer every question, but it answers the most important questions to give the structure of how medical treatment should follow. After those major decisions are made, family is free to make additional decisions in terms of how to augment the decision that the patients have already made. And the patient might even write additional directions if they wanted to, if they thought there was something very specific. But in practice, we have found that these address virtually everything that needs to be done to make sure that the treatment gets on the right tracks and stays there. then that part of the form is signed by the patient, and it can be witnessed by two people or it can be notarized. Then you turn the page over, and the physician says, they sign an attestation that says, I've talked to this person, they understand what the choices that they've made on the other side is, and I'm going to write these orders for EMS to make sure that their wishes are carried out. And there are yes or no orders for, do you want CPR, or does this person want CPR or not? Should they be intubated or not? And should they be transported from their current location or not? And those are orders that meet the standards for the protocols that emergency medical services in Nebraska operate under. So we constructed this to provide the most direction for the medical team who would be receiving this, to provide the most flexibility to accommodate every kind of treatment plan that a patient might want, and to protect everybody who is operating under this, to make sure it is the highest standard of making sure that we knew what the patient wanted and acting accordingly if there should be disagreements about how that happened later. So one of the big questions and confusions is it an advanced directive or is it not? And the question is, it's both. The pulse, for those of you who are familiar with it, is kind of they kind of mushed together the patient's voice and the doctor's voice. And when I look at it, I say, it's kind of like, you know, my daddy said your daddy is strong enough to beat you up. And so it's like, my doctor says that I don't want this and has written an order for this. This form allows both the physician and the patient to have a voice. So the first page is a declaration / living will. It just looks different because it's in a standardized format. So if a patient already has a living will, the NIDO replaces it just as a new advanced directive replaces an old one. We follow the most recent document that has been signed. Because it is an advanced directive, it has all the rights and benefits of the Patient Self-Determination Act, which means every place that receives government money for treating patients needs to accept it. It's transportable, and it can be honored at every facility. It also means that you don't need a host of new regulations or policies. You just need to recognize the form for what it is. So if you've already got a policy for an advanced directive, that's how you would handle NIDO if it came into your institution. Now, from a fine-tuning point of view, you do need to do things slightly differently because it's a different form and people need to recognize it. But from a global legal and policy point of view, very few changes need to be made. But from a procedure point of view, there are some fine-tuning that sometimes needs to be done. And this is a question that I get asked frequently. Can the POA override it? And the truth is no. From a legal point of view, and I've actually just been in court fairly recently with one of these cases where the power of attorney didn't want to do what the very clear wishes of the patient had written. And the judge just said, of course not. You must do what the patient said. I understand you're a well-intentioned family member, but we have to do what the patient wanted. And so this is not specific to NIDO, but if you have a declaration that's actionable, then that declaration has higher legal standing than the power of attorney coming in and saying they want something different. Now, from a legal point of view, it's very clear how to enact that at the point of care is more challenging and requires a lot of training on the parts of the providers who are present. And so the NIDO, even though it's one form and even though it's standardized, it conveys the entire range of treatment from the most aggressive. You can say that a person wants to go to the ICU, they want to be on long-term life support, even if it means being ventilated at a facility post-acute care. They want to be full code and be maintained on artificial nutrition as long as necessary, so it's the most aggressive possible plan. Or it can be a comfort-only plan where the patient only wants to be kept comfortable. They don't want any form of life support, no CPR, no artificial feeding. And there are many options in between there, and I think that that's one of the things that's most powerful about it, is that it gives people the option to start, but then to give very clear reasons for stopping. And I have not seen a document yet that clearly puts that forward in a way that's operationalizable. It is designed to be easy to redo. It doesn't require going to an attorney. It is done in the doctor's office. If you were doing it in a doctor's office, the patient signs it. If they bring a family member or two, both of those people can sign it. If the patient only brings one person, that person can sign it, and a member of the physician's staff can be the second witness. If you wanted to round up somebody in the waiting room, you could do that if the patient were comfortable with that. They may or may not be. But it only requires two signatures, or if the doctor's office has a notary available on their staff, they can go ahead and sign that, or they can go ahead and notarize that. So it's designed so that as your health changes or as your family situation changes, that you rewrite the document to match what your care is then, because we find so frequently people go to their lawyer when they're 50 to get their wills done. They sign, this vanilla living will that doesn't tell us anything. The vanilla living will from when the patient was 50 years old now comes to the hospital when they're 75 or 80 with more serious illness, and it tells us nothing, and it really doesn't help us in any way. And so we recommend that patients look at this at least once a decade. Anytime they get a new diagnosis or a significant change in a current diagnosis, or when they have significant changes in family relationships. So, for example, people might be very motivated for aggressive treatment as long as their spouse is alive, but once their spouse is gone, they think, I don't want to try quite as hard as I did when my spouse was still alive. So those are the indications that we encourage people to revisit the decision. On the other hand, we did not require that, because the situation where you would inevitably find yourself is if we said we were going to require this form be re-endorsed every 3 years. Well, great, so 37 months turnover, and the patient shows up with the exact a situation that they described in the emergency room. Well, the document's 37 months old. Is it stale? It said it should have been renewed at 36 months. And so rather than do that, we make strong recommendations that people refresh it on a regular basis or at when things change. But that's incumbent on the patient themselves rather than on following up with the form. And so, great, there's a form. They say, thanks very much for making the form. Now what do you do? Well, there's a strategic deployment, and this webinar is part of it. So 2017 was all about development and logistic pilot. So in the Omaha area, we've been piloting this largely through the Methodist Health System, but also through the Nebraska system in both Bellevue and University, and in the Fremont system. We have a couple hundred of them out there. We've got EMS on board, and they're working swimmingly. We've got patients who have been readmitted, and the hospitalists say, oh, this makes such a difference. And so that's exactly what we were looking for. We had what the patient wanted at the time we needed it. The next step is to prepare our healthcare systems. So really diffusion about how do we spread this in a way that it will work for everybody and to get help, because it's got to be done jointly between a healthcare provider and a patient. We need a prepared healthcare system to work with patients. And then finally, we need to work with activating patients. So in these interim phases, we are only making these available through healthcare providers. We're not doing any kind of direct-to-patient advertisements or marketing because the healthcare system isn't ready. But as soon as the healthcare system is ready, we can go ahead and continue with this. So Veneto is the basis for a system of care. It, by itself, it's just a piece of paper, right? And so the system is made up of different parts. There are planners, and those are the patient and medical professional dyads. And that can be done in many ways, but it's that activated patient who talks to their doctor about what their choices are. And in that group, I find there's low-hanging fruit, which are the people like my mom who says, if something happens to me, just shoot me. And she knows exactly what she wants, and she just wants, you know, she wants to be kept comfortable and let go, and she's going to go to her doctor and say, this is what I want, check, check, check. Those are the easy ones. The hard ones are, of course, when you've got the patient who really needs to think about it, and they're having a harder time about it. And that requires a higher level of sophistication on your healthcare providers, and certainly more than we can do in the context of this phone call. Then we've got the plans. Those are the pieces of paper that have the decisions on them. And then those are transferred to the performers. Who performs the things that are involved there? It's EMS. It's the people who are in our emergency department. It's our hospitalists or our doctors who are seeing people in the hospital. And it's the facilities to whom the patients are transferred post-acute care or where they're living. And so those are the people who constitute the system of care. So NITO is the basis of a community-based program. A plan is no good by itself unless the community is involved. So you've really got to think about how do you define the system in your community. And Nebraska is a state where the communities vary tremendously. You can be a community without a local hospital and everybody gets transferred someplace else. You can be in a community like Omaha where we've got, you know, half dozen different hospitals and they all are part of different healthcare systems and need to meet those regulations. So define the system as it exists in your community. We have your EMS or first responders absolutely need to be involved. The hospitals that we're affiliated with need to be aware of what's going on and have a plan to anticipate these forms coming in. Then you need a couple of doctors or nurse practitioners or physician's assistants, who's ever the people who are seeing your patients, and some facilities to whom they will be transferred. And if you get that group of people around a table, you can have some strategy meetings and say, hey, we need a way to help people maintain their voice, and we think that this is a pretty nifty tool that we can use. Oh, how do you think we could go about using it? And it really doesn't take as much. You know, it took us a really long time to come up with all the legalese about making this form work. But once the form was available and we started showing it to people, people really wanted it. EMS was tickled pink to have something that would be this consistent because they're called into situations all the time that they find hard to manage. The hospitalists were delighted. They would love to know what the patient wanted when they came in. So it doesn't, once you can present something concretely to the community, people are pretty excited about the idea of making it work. And so you just start a small test of change with the collaborating community. And then as, you know, you're going to correct a couple of errors along the way or change your process along the way. And as people see it work, there will be a natural diffusion across the community of people who want it. And then over time, we will get to the point where we have enough providers on board that we'll be able to go to the public with whatever makes sense in your community. We're fond of the Speak for Yourself campaign, but anything that works in your community would be appropriate for your community. And so we're looking for ways to think about how would we get started in all these various communities? What do we need? We've got a starter set of materials that are available. So we have the form as I described it, which includes the declaration and the physician orders, and that's the form that most people will have. There's also a set of standalone orders that is only the physician order, and the reason for that is some people don't have capacity to make decisions, and according to Nebraska law, at this point, their loved one can't make a declaration on their part. They can help craft the decisions around their medical care, but they can't make a declaration, and so I know that sounds a little goofy, but it's the truth, and that's one of the things that we would eventually ask the legislature to fix. But in the meantime, we don't have a fix for it. So there's just a standalone order. So if you've got a couple and one of them has dementia and the wife says, I know he doesn't want X, Y, or Z, you could write an out-of-hospital DNR and do not intubate order for that person, but they just can't have the declaration part. There are wallet cards, and so if you've got patients who are more functional and they're out in the community, there's a card that has that contains the three orders, and then it says, I've got a NITO form, go find it. You'd send it to the person who would be at home to go get it for them. There's a clinician education brochure that goes through everything that I went through with just a little bit more detail. There's a really excellent patient planning form, and it's a four-page document that starts with where are you in your life, here are these four kinds of decisions that you might want to think through, and helps them think about what they might want in those situations based upon where they are in their lives. And then a sample form that they can do. And so you can distribute these and people can bring them back, talk to their doctors about. There's a trifold that can go in waiting rooms or any public setting to gain some more attention to it. There's an office poster that talks about a patient named Don and how he goes through the healthcare system and how it helped him out. And then there's a series of things called The Truth About, and it's like The Truth About Code Status, The Truth About Resuscitation Status, and The Truth About life-sustaining treatments, just because what people see the most is what's on television, and that's so rarely accurate, so that's why we called it the Truth About series. And it just goes through some of the things that people may not understand about that. There's one video that you might get a link for, or we'll be able to post a link for, that we did for healthcare providers, and we have three more videos in the making. One is, why should we think about planning? A second is specifically how to work through the four questions. And a third is how to introduce it to medical environments and physicians so they understand what they're doing on their part of the deal when they're signing the form. So all of those, with the exception of the videos, are available now, and there's a link on the page next. Hospital. So there's a professional website for this is the NebraskaHealthNetwork.com site, and NHN has put all of these forms on their site. So everything that I just read off to you is available. You can download and use it. There's no copyright. The only thing you can't do is change the form. The form we need to maintain continuity of, because as soon as it becomes non-standard, we're all in trouble. So the actual NIDA form and the standalone orders themselves cannot be altered. But that, but you're, everyone is free to use them. And so I've got a couple more slides that go through detail, but I'm not going to use those unless we need to. But I figure at this point it would be great for me to take a drink of water, and it would be great to get whatever questions you guys might have.
Dr. Lucas, I actually got kicked off of the WebEx, so I'm going to you move the slides for me if that's all right.
Okay.
So thank you for doing that. We are going to take some treats or some questions now. And thank Dr. Lucas for providing this excellent presentation. And while people are just preparing to ask questions, we'd like to see if there were any questions submitted through chat. To ask a question of Dr. Lucas, please push *5. Or you can also chat your questions in. So, Paula, can you tell me if there's any questions in chat?
Yes, we have one question. Do the forms come in Spanish?
Not yet. The question is, do the forms come in Spanish? And we have not made them in Spanish yet. The issue that we have and that we need to wrestle with is that the forms, it is possible that the forms are going to continue to be in English, but the educational materials and the translation of them would be available, because the forms have to be accessible to the people who are receiving them. So the EMS and the emergency rooms, et cetera, need to be able to act on them. So at this point, we have not translated them, but we intend to.
Thank you, Dr. Lucas. Is there another question, Paula, in chat?
Yes. Another question comes from Shaylin. Are there any issues with utilizing the NIDA form out of state?
So the NIDA form would follow the same guidelines as are covered by the Patient Self-Determination Act. And remember that that any time a healthcare professional knows what the patient wants, we are obligated to do that. So if a patient came in saying, I do not want CPR, and signed it and dated it on the back of an envelope, the healthcare provider is actually obligated to do that. And so there's not the kinds of obstacle to taking things from one state to another state. It's just that the forms tend to be more widely, you know, they are more tailored to individual states. But because this meets the standards of an advanced directive, it's covered by the Patient Self-Determination Act, and as such, any place that you would go to the hospital is obligated, or any healthcare institution is obligated to accept it.
We do have another question, Tammy. Would you like that one? No.
Yes.
Okay. Was the governor-appointed palliative care committee involved, or is this the fruit of that committee?
No. I'm not even certain that that committee has met yet. They may have had one meeting, but that committee, this group has been meeting for quite some time, and that committee has quite recently been appointed. And I'm not certain that the committee's focus is on this as much as it is on what constitutes good quality palliative care. So I'm not even sure if this is within their purview.
Okay. I just want to check quick with Nikki to see if anybody's in the phone queue.
Yes, I do have one question from Litzberg M. Just a moment. Okay.
Sharon from American Medical Center. Can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Great. So currently we use a pulse form, and so we're just wondering how we transition from the pulse to the NITO. Do you have any suggestions?
Yeah, I think that you could just I'm sorry, can you tell me what community you're in?
Central City.
Yeah. So I think that you can, because at this point there isn't any, there's nothing exclusive about either of those forms, I think that you could just begin using the NITO, making it available in all the places that you currently utilize the iPulse, the pulsed forms. And then when patients come back to the doctor and say, hey, we have a new form, would you like to utilize that just so it's more consistent? Or the next time it's time for them to think about renewing it, just renewing it on the current form. I think the NITO offers a couple of advantages because the pulse is a physician order, a physician can't order when the patient would want to stop treatment. And so those forms don't have that option available. And I think that what makes the NITO more powerful, and I also think it makes it more powerful, but it makes it more compatible with some of our more conservative members who are really worried about right to life. Because you're not saying, I'm not going to try, it gives you the ability to try and then stop. And that's much more compatible with the more conservative people in our community than just a firm yes or no. So I think there are reasons to think about it. But I think you could just overlap them for a while and just say, you know, over the course of time, you would replace the existing form.
Okay, thank you.
Nikki, do we have another question by phone?
No, I don't have any other questions on the line.
All right, Paula, I see there are a couple more questions in chat. You want to go ahead with those?
Uh-huh. So from Don, in the past, healthcare personnel were not allowed to witness advance directive forms. Did I understand correctly that now, as long as one of the witnesses were family, et cetera, the other could be a nurse aide, et cetera?
Yes, that's actually a misunderstanding in the law, and it's because Nebraska has two different laws. One is the rights of the terminally ill, which is for declarations, and the declaration law says that a single representative from the healthcare facility can act as a witness. The power of attorney law is very explicit in that a healthcare provider cannot witness the power of attorney, but this is not a power of attorney document. And so at some point, those two became conflated and people just said no healthcare providers can sign the form. But if you go to the Rights of the Terminally Ill Act, it very specifically says that one of the witnesses can be an employee of the healthcare institution. I think it's important that the doctor or nurse practitioner or physician's assistant who is actually signing the orders not be a witness, but another person can be, and that's in statute.
Very good. Paula, is there another question?
Yes, this is from Chris. So in collaboration with palliative care when the patient is in the hospital, can this be done as input as inpatient as well as in doctor's offices? How are the education of the physicians going to take place?
So absolutely. The question is, can we do it on the inpatient side? And absolutely. And we are finding that to be just a really ripe area for doing it. And I would say at least half of the forms that we have in distribution in Omaha now have come from our palliative care inpatient or outpatient teams, just because we're having such detailed conversations with people. So the first answer is yes, absolutely. You can do it any setting where you have a medical professional and a patient who have come to an agreement about what their choices are. That form can be signed. The next question is, how will doctors be trained? And that's a whole other thing. I have several different talks about how to train doctors, and it ranges from what I currently call the low-hanging fruit, which is the minimum standard is the doctor has to understand the orders that they're signing and what it means to declare a patient to have capacity, which is actually very clear because patients are getting consent doctors are getting consent from patients all the time. There's generally an assumption about capacity. And then just to have that conversation. So that's the lowest level. And then you go to the people who need a little bit of conversation, and then you need the kind of the highest tier, which I would tend to delegate to our friends in palliative care if you have those people available in your community where you've got a resistant family or a family who's having a hard time understanding the choices and what their medical situation is currently. But the training to have those kinds of conversations is a little more challenging. Now, on the other hand, the educational material that is on this website is really quite good. And if you have a doctor who's just inclined to do this kind of work or somebody who thinks it's important, it doesn't require much training. It requires training to have the more sophisticated conversations.
Thank you, Dr. Lucas. I think I saw one more or a couple more questions. We have 4 minutes left in the presentation.
Okay. So I'd like to say one thing quickly, which is, so right now, NHN kind of is holding the banner for this because they're the ones who helped so much in the creation of it and made their marketing people available to do all the drawings and all the forms. But we're actually beginning an entity which is going to be like a placeholder as this becomes, through this diffusion phase. I'll be looking for contact information from you all to talk about how we get regional representation, how we provide speakers bureaus, how we disseminate this more thoroughly. But because of my transition at this time, we wanted to give this talk for you guys now, and probably in about a month that larger organization will be available that we can kind of seek membership for and have a website up that'll be more specific about doing the trainings and the community pieces. So if we've got time for one more question, and I think actually the website for the new organization is going to be called NebraskaNeeDoh.org, and that'll probably be up within a month.
Okay. All right, Paula, we have time for one more question, and if we continue to have more questions, I will offline ask Dr. Lucas, and we will post those on our website. So is there one more question?
Yes. How do EMS personnel access the NEDO form quickly?
So EMS, when we do the training, for patients who are frail, we suggest that we put the NEDO form, if they're living at home, on the refrigerator. If they're in a facility, it's on the front of their chart or held by their bedside someplace. For people who are not frail, so for people who just want to make their wishes explicit, we're recommending that family know where they are so that you keep it in the most likely place and that you keep the wallet card in your wallet so that EMS is at least aware of it.
All right. We do have one more question. Do we have time for that one?
I'll talk about.
Okay. Rewriting question to attendees. If none of the content or order is changed, is it acceptable to create an electronic version of the form to transcribe the information that is on the written form? This would not replace the written form or signatures, but be a more readily available form that would be accessible within the EHR.
Very good question. So the first answer is yes. So what we do at Methodist is when the patient comes in, it scans into our record, and it goes into a specific place in the record so that it triggers an alert in our banner so that every physician then in the system, whether you're in an office or in the hospital or you're in a department someplace, can find that NEDO quickly. So that is a possibility, and if it works within your EHR, you could do that as well. The issue that you have to deal with, though, then is if you have a form that came in earlier and the patient comes in on a subsequent admission, you need some process to assure that that's still what the patient wanted. If you did, what our lawyers have told us is that the most recent information you have is what you should go with. And so if a patient has given you something you go with that information unless they've given you a second piece on top of that. But you just need to make sure that your policies and procedures about assuring that or at least asking if there's any additional information are in place. One of the things that this new entity would be looking at is there are some states who actually have a registry function where instead of carrying a piece of paper, you just say, I'm Lou Lucas 123, go look at my record, and it would be, you know, it would be an app or a website or a registry someplace, but that's not available in Nebraska at this point. But there are a couple of states that are trying that idea.
Thank you, Dr. Lucas. I do want to say there are a couple of questions, I think, on the phone, and I want those people to either send me an email so that I can ask these questions of Dr. Lucas and get back to you. If you have any questions, you can email. If you would forward the slide, one slide, Dr. Lucas, you can email us with any questions you have. Can that slide move forward one,
Dr. Lucas? Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. There's our contact information. We want to thank you for your participation today, and we hope you found the information valuable and applicable. We want to really thank Dr. Lucas for helping make this such a successful event, and we appreciate your time and participation, Dr. Lucas. We want you to visit the Great Plains website at greatplainsquin.org for resources, tools, and webinars being led by the Great Plains Quin. Again, be sure to join if you're not currently a LAN member, just so you can receive notifications on future educational offerings provided by GP Quin. We ask all attendees to complete the evaluation form for today's event to offer us feedback and help us plan and coordinate future events like today's. Your input is important, and we want to be sure that we're meeting your needs in our educational offerings. So thank you again. This concludes our presentation. Have a great afternoon, and again, if you have any questions, please email either Paula or myself, and we will get those answered. Have a great day.